Welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. I know there's a lot that there's a lot of competition out there tonight where you can go. Just I want to say one thing. A few people mentioned to me the I talk a lot of Hebrew, and if I'm talking too much Hebrew and you don't understand what the word is, please, you know, stop me or just like signal to me and I'll translate what the word is. All right, so I'd like to start. Last time we were talking, we started with the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash, and we got a little bit into what did the world look like before the Jews were coming back. What did Eretz Yisrael look like when the Jews were coming back? And it was a world dominated. It was a Persian world. The Persians were the head superpower. And that's going to change in a very, very short amount of time. And it's going to have very severe repercussions to the Jews in Eretz Yisrael. So, but the Jews, they came back, and it was very, very difficult. And, you know, if you wanted to draw, we were mentioning last time, we drew just a couple of analogies just to what Eretz Yisrael looked like, you know, when the Jews were coming back. Just 150 years ago, a lot of the same problems. And back then, in the second Beis HaMikdash, there were some great personalities that came in and changed everything. The two were probably, if you could point to two great personalities that really made the difference. There were many great personalities, including prophets, Nevi'im, and great person. But the two that you could probably point to that made all the difference was Ezra and Nehemiah. And just to recap a little bit, just what we did yesterday, some of the accomplishments of Ezra and Nehemiah, and that is that there was a community there that had been there for some years, and it was a very depressed community. They came with idealistic motives to go ahead and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, and they were coming back to the land of Eretz Yisrael. And then as they got there, there were a lot of impediments. Things got in their way. The locals, the people around them, started terrorizing them, and they wouldn't let them do what they wanted to do. And they also sent back the Persian government, the ones, their sponsors, who originally gave them permission to build, retracted due to slander that was being done. So when the community that was there, quite a few thousand, it was a mess, basically. And they were actually, some of the Jews had intermarried into non-Jewish wives, and there was Chilul Shabbos, or there was businesses in Shabbos at least. And Ezra and Nehemiah come in, and very, very quickly, Ezra is the ruchnius person. They say Ezra, I don't know if I mentioned last time, but it says that the Torah would not have been given through Moshe Rabbeinu. The Torah could have been given through Ezra. It says it wouldn't have been through Ezra, then comes Shmuel HaKatan. But that's where we put Ezra. We're putting Ezra in the category, in the circle of Moshe Rabbeinu. And what he does is he sets the tone for the next 420 years. As we'll hopefully, Mr. Chen will see a little bit more. But he comes there and he starts dealing with the people and he starts teaching them. And then shortly after he comes another person by the name of Nehemiah. Nehemiah happened to have been I guess you could say a Navi, so to speak. And he was the cupbearer of the king, and he had he had influence with the king, and the king was predisposed to him and actually gave Nehemiah an army to work with. So as Ezra was teaching the people and telling them what to do, well, he had Nehemiah's backing that if they didn't do what they were supposed to do, so then they had to answer to Nehemiah and his army. Plus the fact that Nehemiah and his army was able to stem the locals. Nehemiah, we mentioned last time, he actually built the walls of Yerushalayim. And that gave tremendous amount of protection. Until then, people can come in, can come out. He came in before he announced himself. He went around overnight, looking at the wall, surveying what he needed to do. And it was like a miraculous project. That the time that it was completed was in a very, very short amount of time. Within a short amount of time, he had the walls of Yerushalayim up, which gave a lot of security to the Jews in Yerushalayim. So Ezra Nehemiah, some of their accomplishments we mentioned they had a big meeting, and they went through everybody's yichus, and they said, okay, who are you married to, and who are you married to, and nope, I'm sorry, you're going to have to get rid of that wife, and you're going to have to get rid of that wife. And as a community, they were able to really put a lot of pressure on those people, and pretty much most of the people, if not all of them, they did have a few problems, but most of the people were most of the people, in fact, did get rid of their foreign wives. So you're not missing too much. I just got to the first line that one of the things that they removed. So assimilation wasn't an issue anymore. Secondly, they closed the gates on Shabbos. The business, the market day happened to have been on Shabbos. And there were ways, you get a partner with a guy and you don't write things down. And there are ways that you can do a business deals that are not Minatora. It was at this time that Ezra actually made up a lot of takanos on Mekach and Memkar, deals of selling, buying and selling, that today we don't do a lot of these things from those takanas. Besides all that, he didn't rely on that, but he actually closed the doors. And the gates were not open, they were only open very, the single gate, if you have a big gate, and inside the big gate, and the Nehemiah rings at this small door, so they allowed some of the small doors to come in. They actually started to set up their wares outside the gate. But in a very short time, he was able to stop any Chilul Shabbos that was going on. He also did something else which was really amazing. And it was a large, large gathering, which they called the Bris Amana, and he called all the Jews together. And this was like a gathering for a tshuva gathering. He got everybody together, of course, with the Chilul Shabbos and the wives, but he also got them, it was a gathering for tshuva. And it brings down that how they recommitted themselves to following the Torah. He made takanas. Now he also did something else, Ezra, and this really comes from Ezra, and that's Kriyas HaTorah, something that we do, I guess, every week, at least three or four times a week, and that is Kriyas HaTorah. Kriyas HaTorah, Min HaTorah, the chiyuv is to read the Torah once a week, Shabbos morning. Moshe Rabbeinu came around. Moshe Rabbeinu came and he said he wanted to add another time of reading the Torah, and he added Mincha, Shabbos afternoon. So up until Ezra, during the entire first base of Mikdash, the Jews were reading the Torah on Shabbos in the morning and the afternoon. Ezra came along and he said he set it up that the Torah should be read in addition to Shabbos. It should be read Monday and Thursdays as well. And it should be read, a small aliyah, three people called up, but that is what Ezra set up as well. To this day, we are reading the Torah three times a week, Monday and Thursdays as well. I guess the idea being is that we don't want 3 days to go by without any Torah learning. So the Mondays and Thursdays, you don't have 3 days that go by without opening up, without learning the Torah. He also set up a judicial system. This is Bezdin's, and he set up an amazing system that he really did. The setup was that in every single town, he set up that there was a Bezdin that was set up, and the Bezdin met on Mondays and Thursdays. I guess it went in very well with what he was doing. If, let's say, you lived in outside towns and you didn't have a Sefer Torah in your area, or you didn't have a minyan, So what they would do is you'd come, the markets were now set on Mondays and Thursdays, and during on the same days of the markets, the Bezdin was in session, and you can go ahead and you can get a minyan or, you know, a post-minyan, you know, if you davened at home, you come a little later and you can hear Kriya Satorah. And this was all done, that this was all set up that Mondays and Thursdays, to such a point where, if anybody's familiar with the Gemara in Ksuvis, so the Gemara in Ksuvis brings down that the weddings, Jewish weddings, used to take place on Wednesday nights, and very, very specifically Wednesday nights. What was the reason for the Wednesday? Why Wednesday night? Because if there was a claim that let's say the woman was not faithful or there was an issue, the next morning, Thursday morning, Bezdin met. So it was you know, traditional. Wednesday night was the days of weddings. Thursday morning, if there was an issue, Bezdin was open and you'd come into Bezdin. They were afraid that, you know, if you had to wait an extra day or two, then you may, if there was a problem, you may, you know, either not be so upset about the problem, and you may just say, you know what, forget it, I'm not gonna go to Bezdin, or you're gonna think it's not a big deal. But we wanted, if there was an issue, if there was something that was wrong, we want you to the next morning to go to Bezdin. You could probably ask, if that's the case, how come they didn't make weddings on Sunday night, right? What's wrong with that? So the Gemara discusses that. And I guess in the day, the answer to that is in the days before refrigeration and freezers. So to make a wedding on a Sunday night, you can't start working until Motzei Shabbos. It means, you know, as it is now, the caterers, you know, are working from the morning to the, and that's with everything that they have. But in order to facilitate the wedding, and you don't have refrigeration, so it's much easier to have a wedding Wednesday night when you could start working Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, as opposed to Shabbos being there. So that's one of the reasons, one of the answers that the Gemara gives. As a matter of fact, this, if you know, once we're in Kislev already, I could just throw something in terms of Hanukkah. So during the time of Hanukkah, what there was, one of the terrible decrees was that any lady that was first getting married, the first time getting married, so before she can go to the chuppah, she had to spend the night with the hegemon, with the Syrian governor. Okay, and that's where she had to spend the night, and that was a terrible decree. So how did the Syrians know, you know, the Greeks, how did they know that when the weddings were? They knew because that was the tradition. The weddings were on Wednesday night. So the Gemara brings down that at the time of Shmad, which is during this time, what they did is they used to send out invitations. And you know how today when, you know, you want people to come at a certain time, you know, you write like 6:30 p.m., knowing full well nobody shows up till 7:30, right? So there they had wedding invitations that they sent out Wednesday night. And everybody knew they better come Tuesday night. So what they did is they moved the wedding a night earlier so that, you know, when it came time for the wedding, the hegemon, the Greek in charge say, hey, where's the wedding? What's going on? There was no wedding. Or look, she was already married. The decree is before she's married. But that's what would happen at the times of the Greeks, that the Jews would have to circumvent the Greek laws in order not to these terrible Greek laws that were going on at the time. So that's the but that was something that was set again all the way from the time of Ezra. The next thing is the besides that, there was a learning system, an educational system. How did anybody learn Torah? You learned Torah from the fathers to the sons. If you keep in mind, when Ezra came to Eretz Yisrael, so he couldn't get two groups to come with him. One were the Levim, and the one was like the main Talmidei Chachamim. A lot of the Talmidei Chachamim wanted to stay back in Babel. But so what Ezra did is he took upon himself to make sure that there was an educational system in place, and sometime later it was refined that that if you have 25 students to a Rebbe, anything more, he has to have an assistant, and by 40 or 50, you have to break the class up. It's a Gemara in Baba Basra, right? If I'm not mistaken. Remember who it was? I forgot the name of the one who redid the system. But one of the main things was that Ezra was very, very... education, the Torah learning, had to have been on the highest level, and he accomplished that as well. The level of learning was tremendous, and it produced, you know, all the Torah that came out from Eretz, that came out all the way through from the Tanayim through the Amorayim, came from Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael. The last one is, I just skipped the number 8 for a second. Number 9 is he created the Anshei Knesset Gdolah was like a legislative body. Besides being a judge, the Anshei Knesset Gdolah we mentioned again, we're going to talk about it a little bit soon, but it was 120 members, and besides being like the Sanhedrin, the highest court of the land, it was also a legislative body, that it made laws. And it not only judged, but at the same time made laws, takanas, and this was the, I guess, when the Anshei Knesset Gdolah was done with, so then Sanhedrin took over, they would continue that capacity as well. But it wasn't just judicial, it was legislative as well. The last thing is he wanted to make Eretz Yisrael the central focus of the Jewish people. In other words, wherever the Jews live, they should know that anybody had a question, the question should be addressed to Yerushalayim, to the Anshei Knesset Gdolah, and then after the Anshei Knesset Gdolah, to the Sanhedrin. That was supposed to be the central body of the Bnei Yisrael. And it's very interesting because during this time, there was a outpost of Jews that lived in what is it called? Elephantine. It was all the way down in Egypt, down south Egypt. There was a regiment, a whole army of soldiers, and they were Jews, and they lived there with their wives, and they had questions. They said, "Look, you know, we want to live like Jews, and we have these, the papyrus. We have the Elephantine papyrus. We have the questions." That were sent, questions of the answers that was given back, of what these Jews that were there, what they live, where they work. It just happened to have been that, let's see if, where I get my bearings. If this is, Eretz Yisrael, do I have it right? Yeah, this is Eretz Yisrael, so they were somewhere down here. So, you know, for them to send, it was Palestine. This is Eretz Yisrael. Here's around where you should be in Jerusalem, and just it was like they were at the end of the world, guarding the empire, the Persian, Greek, and later the Greek Empire, and they sent their shilas to Yerushalayim, and that's exactly what Ezra wanted. You send us your shilas, and we'll set you up. Okay, any questions on, yeah?
Can you elaborate on what it means for the Anshei Knesset Gdolah to be above the Sanhedrin traditionally?
I guess so. I'm only debating if I should, you know, we're going to talk about the Anshei Knesset Gdolah as a body in of itself. But this was a body that was, and Ezra put together. It was 120 members. Among the members were Nevi'im, the greatest. These were the 120, I guess, greatest people in Klal Yisrael at the time, and he used this as the beginning to make to form Eretz Yisrael in the beginning. As I'll talk about the Bnei, the Anshei Knesset Gdolah, they died of attrition. In other words, when somebody passed away, they were not replaced. And the last one to pass away was Shimon HaTzadik, which was some 50, he must have been a young man when he joined the Anshei Knesset Gdolah. He ended up being the Kohen Gadol, and about some 50 years later, he passed away himself. I guess as they passed away at some point, it just turned into what we would have the Sanhedrin, which would be the high court. But I guess just at the start of it, it was a body that started. Okay. Now, the Beis HaMikdash, just talking about the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash was built in four times. The first time it was built when the Jews came back by Ezra, at the time of Ezra. And Ezra, by his time, it was a functioning Beis HaMikdash. Shimon HaTzadik, towards the end of the life of Shimon HaTzadik, it was rebuilt again. It was rebuilt again after the story of Hanukkah, shortly afterwards, by the Chashanayim. And then once again by Herod, which was about 100 years before the destruction. The first time it was built, Ezra built the Beis HaMikdash. For whatever reason, he decided not to collect money from Babel. I'm sure that world Jewry would be more than happy to send their checks and to make their donations and get their walls, all their names on the walls and everything. So, but Ezra did not want that. I'm not sure why he didn't want it. Maybe he was hoping that that would encourage Aliyah, you know, that courage that people should come to Eretz Yisrael. But for whatever reason, he only wanted to collect, he only wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash from the people that were there. And because of that, there was really no money there at the time. And they built the building. Chazal tell us that when that building was built, people cried. You know, people were happy on the one hand that we have a Beis HaMikdash after 70 years. The Beis HaMikdash is up. They were bringing Karbanos again. But many cried because there were still many that remembered the Beis HaMikdash, the first Beis HaMikdash. And the contrast was there. The first Beis HaMikdash was built by Shlomo, was rebuilt again, was refurbished later by one of the kings. I'll recall his name in a minute. And but it was a beautiful building. And this was just very, very basic, nothing special about it. So they had a building and they had things functioning again, which was. All in all, was a tremendous accomplishment. But not only that, but what also the first Beis HaMikdash did is it had there was a lot of things that was in the first Beis HaMikdash that was not in the second. And some of the things were, of course, the menorah of Moshe. That was the menorah of Moshe, the Aron. Tzitzenes Haman is that Hashem told Aron to take a measure of the mun. Now the mun evaporated by the afternoon. If whatever was left outside, it melted out. And if it didn't, if you kept it overnight like you weren't supposed to, it rotted. But I guess there was one measure of mun that Hashem told Moshe to tell Aaron to keep it in the Beis HaMikdash. And this is going to be for a testament that there was mun. As a matter of fact, towards the end of this first Beis HaMikdash, when Yirmiyahu was, Gemara brings down, Yirmiyahu was talking to the Jews, and he's telling them, he says, look, you know, what's with Torah? What's with learning? And they said, Rebbe, they said, Yirmiyahu, you call a Navi Rebbe? Yeah, Rebbe, yeah, Rechav, okay. Yeah, just wondering, what do you call a Navi? You call him Rebbe, you call him Navi. But they called and they said, Yirmiyahu, what do you want from us? We have parnasa we have to make. We don't have time to sit and learn. And what Yirmiyahu did is he went into the Beis HaMikdash and he pulled out the Tzitzenes Haman and he says, look, your fathers were in the desert, and you know they didn't have anything, and Hashem supported them. So you know, you learn Torah, Hashem will support you too. That was what brings the Gemara brings down there. But that Tzitzenes Haman was not there. The stick of Aaron. The stick of Aaron was that's the mock. This is the stick. I guess it was Moshe's stick, but Aaron used it when the Bnei Yisrael were saying, this is after the rebellion of Korach, and they were complaining. They say, you know, how do we know that Hashem is choosing Aaron over everybody else, over all the Shvatim? So they made a test. They took everybody's stick and they put it in the Beis HaMikdash. And Aaron's stick too. And when they came the next day, Aaron's stick had flowered, and that was to show that Aaron was the one who Hashem wanted, and that stick was gone too. Along with that, with the next two is Nevuah. Nevuah and Urim V'Tumim. Urim V'Tumim was an unbelievable thing. It was what a great gift. And that was one of the big day kahuna was the breastplate. And the breastplate was something that was, it folded over, and inside you would put Hashem's name. And it's on the stones. There were 12 stones on the breastplate, each one for a different shavit, and there were words on it. It had the name of every shavit, and then it also had the words Avram Yitzchak Yaakov Kel Yeshurun or Bnei Yeshurun. It had all these letters on, and you'd ask it a question, and letters would light up. Of course, you needed to understand how to put the letters together, but that's what the Urim V'Tumim was. It was mainly for kings. The Kohen Gadol would wear it. The king would ask the question, and he would get a response. That wasn't there. I think those two go hand in hand. Nevuah, Urim V'Tumim go hand in hand. We didn't have that as well. It also says a miracle that the fire on the Mizbeach was a form of a crouching lion. All these miracles were not in the Beis HaMikdash. They were not in the Beis HaMikdash. However, in the second Beis HaMikdash, they still had quite a number of miracles. Quite a number of things we could call as a miracle. First thing is that a woman never miscarried in the Beis HaMikdash. I guess there were certain smells there. You have to realize the smells of burning animals and maybe looking at the animals that were cut up, and but never a woman never miscarried, meat never spoiled, which is also I guess for 410 years, and who knows how many thousands and tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of carbonos that were going through, nothing ever spoiled. There were no flies, also tremendous miracle. In the there were no flies. The Navi brings down that Elisha, he had it, Isha Shinamis know that Elisha, the student of Eliyahu, how did she know that Elisha was a Navi? Because she said that whenever Elisha came, there were no flies. So if it was a certain amount of Kedusha, flies are not attracted. They stay away. So in the Beis HaMikdash, with all the Kedusha, there were no flies. The Kohen Gadol never became tummy in Yom Kippur. As a matter of fact, if a Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur, that was his day, and he had a lot of avodas to do. If he became tummy, that would be a problem. And to that effect, every year they would always make a secondary Kohen Gadol. They'd have somebody as a replacement, just in case the Kohen Gadol became tummy, and they never had to come on to that. Rain never extinguished the fire on the Beis HaMikdash. Mizbeach never got too hot. Now you have to realize it was a fire there that was a constant fire. It never went out for 400 years. Now, no matter how you, that fire should have made the stones of the Mizbeach just so hot that Kohanim should not have been able to get up there, and they had to do their avodah on bare feet. The Derech HaTeva, that Mizbeach should have gone up in flames, so it should have been tremendously hot. Number six is a miracle that the smoke of the Keteris, that the never bent by the wind, the smoke went straight up, and the wind wouldn't knock it to the side. It was straight up. It's another miracle that they had. The Lechem Apanim, which was the every Shabbos, every Friday, they would bake 12 cakes. It's called Lechem Apanim with a face because it had a shape to it. They bend it both up on both sides, and then it would they bent it like almost like a U, or a, it would come. Not only would it come up on both sides, it would flat up, and then this it would come in as well on top. And they had 12 of them. And these 12 were baked warm every Friday, and they would switch them on the shulchan, which was in the kutchen, and they would slide the new ones on and slide off the old ones. One miracle was that the old ones, which was from the last Friday, was still warm. It was still warm. But the lechem upon him never spoiled. That also never got the shtei lechem was another type of bread that was brought. With besides the lechem upon him and the shtei lechem, the mizbeach was generally, and the carbon toda, the base of mikdash was generally kosher lePesach, because all the minchas and everything that was done was basically matzah. It was basically matzah or types of matzah. The only things that were real bread was the lechem upon him, the shtei lechem, which I'll talk to you in a second, and the in a carbon toda, a Thanksgiving carbon, you had to bring four types of bread, 10 of each. You had to bring 10, you know, chalos, and one of them was the bread. Four types. Three of the types were different types of matzahs, wafers, matzahs, and the fourth was bread. And not only that, but the carbon toda, you only had a day to eat it. Normally, for a carbon shlamim, you had a day and a half. Yeah, but this carbon tamid, you had four times the amount of bread, and you only had half the time to eat it. Why was that? Why did you do that? You had to eat it by nightfall. Nightfall, 40 breads had to be eaten. So what was the reason for that? So some say a very nice reason is that you can't eat it all yourself. So you have to do is you have to find people to eat it. See, people were going around Yerushalayim, here, please help eat. This is a carbon toda. So they'd say, oh, carbon toda, really? Why are you bringing a carbon toda? So you'd say, well, you know, I was just saved by this, or this happened, or and these good things would happen. So it would be a way of publicizing good things that happened. So those breads never became pasul. They never became tamei or pasul. And the shtei lechem are the two breads that were brought, special carbon brought on Shavuos. Also, that they were brought with, they were breads. So these breads never became pasul, and that was a miracle. Omdim tzufim u'mishtachim u'mirvachim. This is also an unbelievable miracle, in that when people were in the Beis HaMikdash was so packed. People were standing, they were packed together, and you know, I think Baruch Hashem, we've seen like at the Kaisel in the plaza, you know, sometimes Baruch Hashem, you see so many people, they're all there, all packed together, and it gets very tight. However, there were certain times when, that's on Yom Kippur, when the Kohen Gadol would say Hashem's name, and he'd say the real name of Hashem, the Yud Kei Vav Kei name of Hashem, when you heard that, you had to bow down. How is it possible? Everybody's just standing up like this. But a miracle happened when it came time to, when you heard the Kohen Gadol say Hashem's name, Yud Kei Vav Kei, everybody bowed down. There was enough space for everybody to bow down. And that's that was another one of the big miracles. Now, the first eight are different than the last two. The last two is just that there was a snake and a scorpion of a damage in Yerushalayim that's brought down. And nobody ever said Sali Amakom Shalom Yerushalayim. It's too tight. I can't live, or I can't stay overnight in Yerushalayim. Somehow there was always hotel rooms, and there were always places for people to stay overnight. Just as a before you move on, just as a Hanukkah, just something about Hanukkah. So you know, here you have I'm listing for you eight miracles, maybe ten, but eight miracles that happened in the Beis HaMikdash. And what do we do for Hanukkah? What happened by Hanukkah? Hanukkah, there was the Jews beat back the Greeks. We finally took back the Beis HaMikdash. They found a flask of oil just for one day, and they lit it, and it lasted for 7 days. It lasted for 8 days until they were able to make more oil, Betara. So the question is, I would ask the question is, what's the big deal? You got eight miracles going on every day in the Beis HaMikdash. Any takers? So what's the big deal? What was the big miracle of the Hanukkah that we, you know, all year, you know, till today we're lighting the Hanukkah candles for 8 days? So there are many answers to this question. I'll just give you one. I saw in the Modim Zmanim, you know, he with this he answers a lot of questions. But when we say in the Alanisim, it says Vihidliku Neiros. What's the next two words? Bechatzros Kachecha. In the chatzer of the Beis HaMikdash. So what they did is they actually set up a menorah not in the Beis HaMikdash. They set a menorah outside in the chatzer of the Beis HaMikdash. What was the reason why they wanted to set it there? Because they wanted the Jews to know, that's it, there's a new, we got rid of the Greeks. We're back in town, we're back in business. So they wanted to publicize that by using the menorah. So the chatzer of the Beis HaMikdash, you know, that's, you don't see miracles there all the time. All these first eight miracles are in the Beis HaMikdash itself. Beis HaMikdash itself, that's like Hashem's house, you know. Hashem, he can do all these miracles. But a miracle like this that happened in the chatzer of the Beis HaMikdash, that was something special. And that's what we're celebrating. That's the answer of the Moedim Mizmanim. Okay, we are now, I just wanted to just maybe point out just something over here. And that is, a lot of things, you know, we lost Nevuah. Okay, Nevuah was lost. And, you know, what was Nevuah? And what is, you know, there's the Urim Tumim, and down the road, and down the list. So, Nevuah is I guess the definition, just looking around, and I'm sure we could all find much more specific definitions, but Nevuah was something where a person would be so removed from his physical body, and he'd be in a sort of a direct communication with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with Hashem. And it would seem that the clearer, the higher of a level that a person was on, and even in the Nevi'im, who are different levels, that's the closer of communication that you'd be able to get to, and the clearer communication. Of course, Moshe Rabbeinu being the clearest of them all. Also, you would need you need to be building on Klal Yisrael. Klal Yisrael had to, in general, be on a certain level. And when you're standing on Klal Yisrael, so to speak, the Nevi'im were able to reach higher levels. They said about Shmuel HaKatan, which he was a Tana. He lived during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. He said he would have been worthy of having Nevuah, but he didn't because the Bnei Yisrael weren't worthy. Klal Yisrael in general weren't worthy, and therefore he, even though he himself would have been on that level, but he had to build on Klal Yisrael. And the Urim Tumim, we mentioned what it was. Also in the breastplate, I guess it works the same way. A bas kol. What's a bas kol? A bas kol is a heavenly voice. I don't think it's something we have today because, you know, if somebody says that they hear voices, we look a little, you know, we wouldn't say it's whatever. So, but in the time that there were bas kols, bas kol is a heavenly voice, and just before I go to the next slide to talk about bas kols, then there's something called Ruach HaKodesh, which is a low form of Nevuah, which we'll just talk about in a second. And there's also a She'elas Chalom, which is a way of communicating. You make you prepare yourself and you have a question and you put a piece of paper under your pillow and you get an answer. I'd like to share with you a story about that, as well as we have something else called Goral Agra, which I'll talk about that in a second. If you can turn to the next one. Now, bas kol, there were many, these are instances of a bas kol since, during the second Beis HaMikdash. In other words, since the Nevuah period ended, so the Gemara brings down, there was a bas kol that Yonatan ben Aziel, and he was the one who wrote the Chumash, the Targum on the Chumash. Targum on the Chumash was written by Unkelus, and what Unkelus did for Chumash, Yonatan ben Uzziel did for Nevi'im. And what he wanted to do, so people in those days spoke in Aramaic, so he translated the Chumash, the Navi, from Navi to from Hebrew to Aramaic, a very similar language. But he didn't just translate it. he put a lot of things in, things that are not in the pasuk, like hidden things. So he wanted to do this for Ksuvim too. And Abaskal came out and said, I'm sorry, that's it. Navi is enough. Ksuvim is, that's taboo. You can't do Ksuvim. Why? Because there are a lot of things in Ksuvim that have to remain hidden. Like when Mashiach is going to come, and certain things like that, certain hidden secrets, certain things. So the Baskel came out and said, don't do it. Another one came out, so there was a guy that saved Rabbi Gamliel, and he was, the Baskel came out, and he was also rewarded for all to come. Rav Chanina ben Dosa was, it says that he was very poor, right? And he said, and the whole world is fed through the schus of Rav Chanina ben Dosa. And Rav Chanina ben Dosa, all he had one, you know, all he ate one day was like a little measure of food. Another Baskel came out in the debate of Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. Who do we paskin like? And it came in favor of Beis Hillel. It said, even though the Talmidim of Beis Shammai are more charif, they're sharper, but we're going to follow Beis Hillel, we follow the majority. Another Baskel came out with a Repreda. This is a very... This is a nice story. Anybody here in special education? Well, Rav Preda had a student that had to hear everything 400 times. It only went into his mind 400 times. Now, there is some people that, some farshim explain, whenever you see 400 in Shas, it's a guzma, it's an exaggeration. But no matter what, he had to say it a lot of times, more than once, twice, three times, even saying something 20 times is a lot. So Rav Preda said something, he would say over whatever he had to for to a student 400 times. One day he comes into class and he says to the student, he says, listen, I'm in a rush. I have a chassan to go, I don't know, whatever it was, he had to go somewhere. And he says over and he gets in his 400 times. And he says to the student, all right, you got it? And the student says, no, I'm sorry, I didn't get it. So Rav Preda said, my hi, you know, like, what's going on? And I said it the 400 times. So the student says, yeah, but since you told me to begin with that you're going to a, you have to go and you may not finish, so I got the tumult and I was under pressure and I didn't finish. So Rav Preda said, okay, I'm not going to the chasana. And he sat down and he said over to the student another 400 times. A Baskel comes out and he says, Rav Preda, what an unbelievable thing. What do you want? Do you want to live 400 years or everybody in your generation gets Olam Haba? So he picked and he said, all right, I want everybody to get Olam Haba. And in Shemayim they said, you know what? You'll get both. You'll live 400 years and everybody get Olam Haba. That's another recorded that it brings down a Baskel. Another one is a very famous case in Baba Metzia. There's a certain type of an oven called the Tanur Shel Achnai. And whatever the reason, there's a certain way it was put together. And what would happen is, what would happen if you broke it? Now, does it make it tahar or is it still tamei? And it could be it was because it was put together. It was a certain type of the way they made it. And Rabbi Elazar says it's tahar, and the Chacham said it's tamei. And Rabbi Elazar wasn't backing down. He was giving them all a hard time. He says, I'm telling you, I heard from my rebbeim, and it's tahar. And they said it's tamei. And Rabbi Elazar got up and he says, well, if it's tahar, if I'm right, I want all these trees to move 100 feet. And the trees picked itself up and moved 100 feet. And the Chacham, it's still coming. Yeah, well, let's see. You see that stream over there? I want it to go the other way. And instead of going downstream, I want the river to go upstream. And sure enough, the water stopped going downstream and the water started going upstream. Nothing doing. They weren't listening. He says, if the halacha is like me, the walls should start to tumble down. And the wall started tumbling down. And Rabbi Gamliel said the wall should stop and stay out of our business. And the wall stopped tumbling down. It didn't go straight up for the honor of Rabbi Elazar, but it didn't tumble in for the honor of Rabbi Gamliel. So Rabbi Elazar pulled out one more stop. And he says, if the halacha is like me, let them tell it so in heaven. And a baskol came out. And a baskol said, the halacha, what do you want? The halacha is like Rabbi Elazar. And what do you think happened? You think they listened? The halacha says they didn't listen. And you know what they said? They said, lo bashamayim hi. The Torah is no longer in heaven. Hashem gave us the Torah. We decide what the halacha is, and we are paskening the role of the majority. Is paskening that this Tanur is tamei. As a result of this, Rabbi Elazar wouldn't back down. They actually had to put him into cherem. They put him in excommunication, and that's a whole different story that what went on with Rabbi Elazar. But a baskel came out. So the Gemara brings down that somewhere a little bit further down in history, they asked Eliyahu HaNavi, knew what's going on with Hashem, and he said, look, my children beat me, you know. I said, I love that Rabbi Elazar, and they said, no, we're not listening, and they're right. And that was another baskel. It was a form of nevuah, I guess a lower form of nevuah. There's also one I don't have over here. Now, this you could claim it was just voices, but Herod was a slave. He was part of the slaves for the Hashemnayim, his whole family was. And he, it said, the Gemara brings down Baba Basra that he heard a baskel saying that any slave that rebels will be successful. And he rebelled, and he was successful. So that's another baskel that brought down. There are more. There's just a few that are here. Ruach HaKodesh. So what's Ruach HaKodesh? So Ruach HaKodesh is very, very, very interesting because we say that people have Ruach HaKodesh. Talmid Chacham Rashi, they say, it's written with Ruach HaKodesh, and that's really what's written over here. Ramban basically he's talking this really comes from a tshuva in the Derech Chaim that brings down that somebody said that. A Rav wrote his sefer, it wasn't with Ruach HaKodesh. And the question is it slander or whatever? And then he gets into what's Ruach HaKodesh, the Derech Chaim. And he brings down the Ramban. He says that even though prophecy was taken from the prophets, prophecy was sights and visions. Okay, but Ruach HaKodesh, the prophecy of the Chachamim, is a different type. It's wisdom, it comes from Chachma. They know the truth through Ruach HaKodesh. And I think the Ritva says something very similar like that. If a Talmud Chacham who is learning would know things through his learning of Torah, he'd be able to know things impossible to know just through human intellect. And they have like a Kadosh Baruch who graces them, gives them this Ruach HaKodesh, gives them this gift. Rashi, they say, wrote his parish, especially on Chumash, with Ruach HaKodesh. If you want to speak about Ruach HaKodesh, I just heard who said this story? I think Rabbi Shapiro said all of this story about 2 weeks ago. What happened with Rav Chaim Kanievsky? Somebody came to, an older bacher came to him that he was in his 30s, and he was crying to the Reb Chaim, and it's about 2 months ago he came, and he said, look, I can't get married, I'm not finding the right shidduch. And Reb Chaim Kanievsky said to him, your zivug, your bashert, your partner is not born yet. I don't know how that made him feel, but that's what he said to him. But so it ended up 5 weeks later. This same bachur had a vort, and he got engaged to a gioris, a girl who converted 2 weeks earlier. So we know that a gioris, somebody who's Magaya Klai Yisrael, is considered as if they're newly born. So Rabbi Shapiro said he checked this story out, whatever. So how did Reb Chaim know about this? How many stories are there with Reb Chaim? With the Stifler, and with Chazanish, Rav Shach, they say things, they know things, and they have sources based in Ruach HaKodesh, and it's through their Chachma, and it's also it has to do with the Gemara. Also, another Gemara in Baba Basra, it says the Gemara says even though the Nevuah was taken away from the Nevi'im, but it was not taken away from the Chacham. The Gemara asks, Chacham Lav Nevuah, and Navi is it? You know, just so it ends up. So a lot of the Mefarshim explain that the Ruach HaKodesh, the Nevuah, the Ruach HaKodesh of the Chacham is based on wisdom. On Chachma, that the Nebuah is based in there, not so much as opposed to the Nevi'im. They could have been Chachamim too, and they probably were, but they had a different level. It was visions. It was some different level, and different maybe even tracked. So that is something that we have today. Let's just go forward. What do I have next? Now, there's two things. I just, you know. We may think that we don't have any communication with Hashem. You know, I mean, that Ruach HaKodesh enough is he's there, he's talking to us. You know, we just. But there's two things that we have. One is a She'ela Shalom, which is like I mentioned to you before. You have a request and you need something. You need to know something. So what, basically, you have to prepare yourself, and you put the piece of paper or the She'ela under your pillow. You go to sleep and you get an answer. Now, in 1865, is anybody familiar with the books Yerushalayim Shalmaila, Yerushalayim Shalmaila, the Heavenly City in English? It's a wonderful stories about the Yerushalayim of old in the 1860s. It brings down the story. It brings on the story with in 1865 there was a plague that ravaged the city, and already in the 1860s, people, you know, Yerushalayim was starting to pick up. You know, it would pick up by World War One. Before the eve of World War One, there were 50,000 residents in Yerushalayim. After World War One, it was down to 25,000 for whatever, you know, because of the war. But 1860s already, people started coming, and it was a tremendous plague, terrible, terrible plague, and they couldn't figure it out. Then all the Rabbanim got up there and they said, let's go to the place and let's stop and let's learn more and learn more, and they just couldn't figure it out. So Rav Meir Auerbach, who was the Rav of Yerushalayim at the time, and after him came Rabbi Shmuel Salant, and after him it was nobody. They didn't want to appoint Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, and if we get there, we'll get there. But he was the Rav at the time, and he had a Rebbe, Rev Rafal Yedidya Abulafia, who was a Makubal. And basically, it goes through what they learned about how to do a She'ela Shalom, and it explained how what Rav Meir Auerbach did to prepare himself. And he went to sleep, and he woke up, and he had a vision of these words. The letters were written on black fire, and he had a vision of these words. And the words happened to have been in Cherishirim, Doma. What am I missing? Doma Doda Letzvi, right? My dear one is like a Tzvi, only Afer Ha'Yalim. My dear one is compared to a deer and a heart. He may say, Omei Nacha Kaslenu, and he's standing behind our wall. The first part of the pasuk refers to Klal Yisrael being decimated, destroyed. And he said, that's a reference to our plague. And the second part of the pasuk, he said, Oh, Menacha Kaslenu, he's standing behind the wall. So one shot is Hashem, he's behind the wall, he wants to come to us. And the wall is the wall that we built to keep him away. But Hashem doesn't want to stay away from us, he wants to come to us. That's one of the simple pshatim in the pasuk. But Acha Kaslenu was a reference to the Kaisel. And when he went to his Rebbe and he found this, so they realized the reason why the plague was is that because of they were in Yerushalayim, and they were so close to the destruction of Yerushalayim that they should limit their joy. You know, how could you have a joy? You know, you're so close to the destruction, and if you're showing joy at certain occasions, it's like a disgrace for the Beis HaMikdash, for the destruction of the Chorban. So they came out and they made a decree. This is then they were Meir Auerbach got all the Gedolim, all the Rabbanim there at the time to go ahead, and they made a decree that in Yerushalayim you could only have one piece band that would play at weddings. And in effect until today. See, today it doesn't make a difference because you can have like a one piece band that can do everything. You weddings in Yerushalayim. But I remember going to weddings in Yerushalayim, usually you went for the drummer. You had a few singers and you went for the drummer. And most of the weddings that I had, they had the one piece band was the drummer. And then the Shiloh was what's considered Yerushalayim. So I heard that Beitar is not considered Yerushalayim, but Gila would have been and remote. And so this is something which we have today, the Zera Yerushalayim, of not to have more than one piece band from a Shiloh Shalom. And the next one is the Garlak Ra. Now, the Garlak Ra, just give you the background, in the War of Independence, Garlak Ra is used many things. Could be used anywhere or anything. The Gra had a sitter, had a Tanakh. And the Tanakh was made into columns, two columns on a page. And that's how it went from the beginning to the end. And basically, you would use the Garlak Ra, was you would, it's seven sevens. You flip seven times randomly, and then wherever you stop, then you did seven. So seven random, seven pages, seven, you know, double pages, seven one side pages, seven columns. Then you start the column, you do seven psukim, seven words, and seven letters, and then you take that letter and you find the next pasuk that starts with that letter, and then you get your answer. Just a few Garlak Ras. The Reb Aaron Cutler, when he was coming out of Europe, he wanted to decide where should he go. Should he go to Eretz Yisrael, or should he go to America? And he did the Garlak Ra. The Garlak Ra came out to the pasuk of Shmos, or it was in Shmos, and where the pasuk brings out that Aaron, the pasuk is Aaron went out to the midbar to greet Moshe, and that's the pasuk that Reb Aaron Cutler got, and he understood the Garlak Ra, that he understood the pasuk to tell you that he should go to Reb Moshe Feinstein in the midbar, which America was called the midbar, and that's where he came. I had a friend of mine. It's spooky stuff. I heard about the Garlak Ra, that if it tells you to do something, you do it. If you don't, then it's spooky stuff. I don't know if you could do it all the time. I don't know if you know how you have to set yourself up. But a friend of mine said he did it once. He was in Israel, and somebody told him he needed to buy them a chumash. He didn't remember which one it was. It was a Bereishis Shmos Vayikra Dvarim. He did it, and it came out to Bamidbar. So he bought the Bamidbar, and it was the right one. I don't know what that means, whatever. But that was a Garlak Ra. Now there's one very historical Garlak Ra that happened, and it happened during the War of Independence. So there was a place Gush Etzion, which is today Gush Etzion, which is further south of Yerushalayim. The Jews had a yeshiva there, and during the war, they wanted to send replacements, extra men to help with the fighting there. So they sent 35 men, 35 fighters, soldiers. I don't think any of them were from religious or not, but really that really doesn't make any difference whatsoever. They sent 35 soldiers. On the way there, they met up they saw this old Arab man. And the debate among them was, do we kill this man or not? What was the Shiloh? If we let him go, he's just going to go to the nearest town, and then they're just going to come and kill him. Or do we let him go and hope that he doesn't? And they let him go. And he went to the nearest town, told the Arabs. The Arabs surrounded these 35 and killed them, but they killed them the way the Arabs know how to kill. That is a terrible thing. So shortly after that incident, they found the bodies, and since this is smack in the middle of the War of Independence, they did not have time to bury them properly, and whatever, they didn't have time to really take good accurate records, and they buried each of the 35 in, you know, makeshift graves, because at the time they couldn't do anything more, and they tried to mark it as carefully as they could. They were able to, sometime later, like a few months later, whatever, whenever they were able to, they extracted all the bodies. And of the 35, they were able to identify, I think, about 21 of them. The rest of them, they were not able to identify. So they put them all. They put them all in the Mount Herzl. They're all on Mount Herzl, and they just put one next to the other without any identification on them. And they went to the chief rabbi, who I think was Rabbi Herzog at the time, and they said, "Is there anything we can do?" The family said, "Just wanted to know." So Herzog went to Rabbi Levine, and he asked Rabbi Levine. Rabbi Levine said he didn't want to do it, but they convinced him, and finally they did the Gorel Agra. And the way they were doing it is they came up with certain rules. It has to be about the it has to coincide. They picked up a name and they identified a grave. Okay, the first grave on the left, and we're looking for a name. They had like the 12 or 13 names, and they were going to go through the psukim to see if they could find the names. Give me a second.
You give me a second.
I have something here. Okay. So this is when they reburied them. Just amazing. It's like so unbelievable what the psukim that they came onto. Every pasuk, just about every pasuk had to do with war. You could just forward the next one. This is what the chumash looked like. Again, it was in different columns. Keep going. And okay, these are the 35 killed. These are half of them, and the other 35 are the other half. Okay. And if there was an asterisk, those are the ones that they didn't know who they were. So just, okay, now the first one they did is, Mata Binyamin Bagayrol, that was the first pasuk that they got to, Gairol, so Gairol Agra, and they identified this person as Binyamin. The first pasuk that they got to, this I should also mention, before they got to identifying the name, was Lahashem Ha'aretz Meloa. But if you write Lahashem, you write it Lamed with a Hey and a abbreviation. Lamed and a Hey is equal to 35. So it's like, you know, just a lot of things. Keep going. The next one was Vayomer Vayal Shol Vayomer Halo Ben Yamini. And they identified the name with Odit Ben Yamini. This is going to be just Nevshavo Yaakov, Yaakov Ben Atar. Next one was Vayomer Yosef, Yosef Baruch. They gave him the name of Eitan Gaon. That was the person they identified. Beikach Elio was Elio Hershkowitz, and Zvulanama Yitzhak Zvulani, Kohen Necha Alexander Cohen. The next one was the next Cohen. I don't know why they picked one Cohen over the other. Gam Baba Limpo Khali. See, all the, again, a lot of the psukim has to do with war. Khalilei, the pasuk itself has to do with this. Acha Sha'alti Meis Hashem Ushol Tanueli. That's probably it. So, like, you know, here we are. We don't have Nevuah anymore. But Hashem talks to us. We have our ways. We have our Chachamim, our Gedolim today. They have this Ruach HaKodesh, much slower, much little, working on different path, but we have these, we have methods, we have ways of communicating with Hashem. Alright, let me go back to the next one. The Anshei Knesset Gadol, we mentioned this is where we mentioned, but We're going to continue next time with the accomplishments of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah. So first was Ezra, the Beis HaMikdash. Now, the Anshei Knesset Gedolah, as you can see, we mentioned 120 members. By the way, 120 members, the Knesset today in Eretz Yisrael has 120 members. Where did they get that number from? They got it from the Anshei Knesset Gedolah. You know, Mirz Hashem, you know, Mirz Hashem will get them in the same stature. Legislative and judicial body, Nevi'im were among them. It spanned about 50, 60 years, and Shimon HaTzadik was the last surviving member. I guess next time I'm going to pick up with the accomplishments of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah. Had to do with whether it was tefillah, whether it was some of the tefillah, the Mesorah, and different things, the aspects of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah, and then that will bring us into the Greeks, the coming of the Greeks. This is Shimon HaTzadik had a meeting, a very, very faithful meeting with Alexander the Great. So we're going to get from Anshei Knesset Gedolah, and we're going to go into the Greeks. Thank you all for coming.